Martha Dean and her guest today, an old friend and a good one, Gene Shepherd. And then tomorrow, bright and early, we'll all be back at 5 a.m. Have a good day. It's 10 o'clock.
This is Henry Gladstone suggesting you stay tuned as Martha Dean's guest is Gene Shepherd.
Well, that's right, Henry. The guest on the Martha Dean program this morning is an old friend of yours and mine, and a man that who is known by all of the WR listeners and a lot of other people, too, Gene Shepherd.
Good morning.
You look fine.
Well, you seem surprised.
No. Well,
that's a terrible thing to say to a guy. You know, you really look good. I've heard people say that. Just, well, what happened? What did you hear?
Well, you know, you're a night person.
Yes, it's always believed that night people
look
have
terrible
blood
in the morning.
Problems and look terrible. No, that's not true. It's their mind that looks bad, not their body. If you could see my mind, I make Oscar Wilde's Dorian Gray look like a Boy Scout.
Your mind is not in order this morning.
No, my mind is full of pockmarks, and it's an evil thing with red eyes.
Well, I'll just concentrate on the body, then, because it looks fine.
That mustache is very impressive.
That's right, absolutely. Let me see the back of your hair.
Yeah, it's all right. It's cool.
Just right.
Yeah.
Well,
sort of.
It's not short, and it's not long.
No,
it's
no.
Just right.
I tread a middle line. We people at night have to be very careful, because we can get fired very easily. Just because...
You haven't.
No, that's true. That's because we learn footwork early in the business. All night men do.
Do night men have more trouble than day men?
Oh, yes. It's in almost every office, major organization, it is believed by the people who work in it that all operations cease at 5:30. Or at least when they catch the train to Darien.
I'm going to call you on that. They'll take that at the New York Times on a morning paper.
Oh, no. Well, that's a different kind of an outfit. It's the morning guys that are in trouble over there. It's the guys that work after the paper's in bed and all distributed. It's the guys that come in after the excitement.
But around a radio station, the night people are always in trouble, huh?
I have never seen it otherwise.
Well, what do you all do to get you into so much trouble?
Just because we're on at night. That's enough.
You aren't getting a little paranoid.
Oh, no. Although I do believe that once you've been rubbed...
Rubbed.
It's the same thing often to a night guy. But, see, there's nothing open. At night, you know, you get used to drinking 12-hour old coffee. Life when you work at night, there's many little amenities that you're used to that we just don't see. For example, right here at the station.
Is your coffee hot this morning?
It is.
Dear.
I have not had hot coffee in over 6 weeks. That means that I have not been in the station before 2 o'clock in the afternoon in that length of time. The candy machines are always empty by 10 o'clock here. By 8:30... the machines are giving nothing but empty 7-Up cans.
And Barry Farber.
Well, Barry Farber's always here, but that's a doubtful... Barry doesn't come in dispensing coffee. He comes in dispensing you alls.
And he doesn't fill the candy machine or anything.
No, it's funny. When you see Barry, you know that things are getting tough here when the elevator doors slam at 11:14 and Barry makes that last sprint for the studio. You can hear the thunder of feet coming down, and you just better not get in his way. I've seen nice little old ladies get run down by Barry. He says, sorry, ma'am. He comes running into the studio here at that hour.
Did you fill Carnegie Hall a couple of weeks ago, single-handed, standing room only?
I did.
Well, don't be so modest about it.
What can you say? I'm...
How many people can be seated in Carnegie Hall?
Gee, I think around 2,700. It's a big hall.
I know.
Beautiful hall. You know, playing that hall, it's funny, Martha. It's hard to describe what it feels like to walk out on the stage of Carnegie Hall to perform. Not as a guest on somebody's show, but to really go out. And that's why people came to see you. And it's a great feeling. It's a fantastic hall. And I think one of the great cultural landmarks of America, obviously.
It was a good audience?
Great. Of course, as a performer, as a comic on stage, you know, pantomimist, which is the way I work, most of my work on stage, you know, is is visual. It's not verbal. I don't stand on the stage and talk. It's meme, which is what it's the stuff that I did when I first came to New York when I was with New Faces and I worked with reviews and so on. And I miss the visual.
Why didn't you invite me? Everybody else does.
Well, I thought you were invited. Weren't you invited? Oh, I can't believe that.
No.
That's, that baffles me.
I didn't know maybe you were trying to keep all of us at WOR out of Carnegie Hall.
Are you kidding? To get people at WOR to come to anything that you do, you have to have a very strong blackmail lever of one kind or another.
Well, I would have been there.
I know you would have been there. Philosophically, here. You know what I mean. I don't have to go into that.
All right, now, Gene, I'll give you a chance to finish that coffee while it's hot.
Good.
Because
it's an unexpected treat.
Yes, and if you finish that, there's some more in the control room, still hot. You can even have a second cup around here in the morning.
I mainline coffee. I've been known to eat the beans dry.
I haven't said anything about the book that's going to be published in January because I don't want to right now. But I will in a minute or two.
Okay.
Now we'll go to the Flemington Fur Company at Flemington, New Jersey. Oh, no, first of all, oh, look at that. That's Dick Willard. Morning person, brings the coffee.
Yeah.
Brought it hot right out of the control room. I've been asked to tell you about UNICEF greeting cards. This is not a commercial, but it is. Christmas cards.
Yeah, there's a recycling company downtown that just removes old addresses and stuff. You can send them out again.
Are you
believing
that true?
No, I'm telling you the truth, yeah.
Oh, but Gene, don't leave it there because the telephones will come off the wall.
Well, I'm not going to tell them where it is.
You're not?
No, I'm not going to tell people the address of my basement. I mean, are you kidding?
Oh, well, please don't call up because he won't give the address and I don't know it. So don't ask.
And you wouldn't want to know those people anyway. They're terrible people, awful manners.
The kind of people who were raising names
on... They recycle with Christmas cards.
They'd be handy people to know in case you get a summons.
Yes, they are.
Could erase the whole thing.
They're short, fat men with cigars.
All right, if you want to know more about UNICEF greeting cards, call that number, 685-1300. Now, now, this is the Martha Dean Program, WOR New York. My guest this morning is Gene Shepherd. Gene Shepherd, who is heard every single evening... No, not Saturday.
No.
Five nights a week.
I used to be on Saturday.
I know. Five nights a week on WOR.
I was replaced by a turntable.
Well, that's life today, isn't it?
It's radio. Not quite the same.
Gene, the last time you were here, gracious, was it a year ago?
Oh, it's easily that, yeah.
We talked about a book of yours, Wanda Hickey's Night of Golden Memories and Other Disasters.
Yep.
And it did very well.
It was on the Time bestseller list, yeah.
I know. And now, this is not why you're here this morning, to talk about the new book, so I'll talk about it. The Ferrari in the Bedroom.
Yeah. It's coming out. It'll actually be in the stores the 20th of November. The
publication date is not until January.
That's excuse me. That pub date idea is sort of going out of date. It isn't like it used to be.
I know.
And the pub date really is the date when, I guess, theoretically, reviewers can write about it if they decide to. But most books today are in the stores a good 6 weeks before they're actually the actual pub date.
That's right.
And they Dodd Mead tells me that books will be in the store the 20th.
Well, I have some bound galleys.
In fact, all our advertising is it begins something like the first week in December.
Well, this is a pre-publication date. Not interview. Non-interview.
Do you know, looking at that bound galley, do you know that one of the great new hobbies today among people who are interested in books, the real bibliophile, is collecting galley copies of books? Because they're very valuable.
Yeah?
Oh, yes. In fact, if you can get a galley copy, I discovered that a galley copy of my first book, for example, In God We Trust, which I don't have, a galley copy, is worth now around $700. They're very rare. You see, the publisher only made 50 of those that you have in your hand right there.
Well, then
only have one myself.
You don't have one?
Well, I only have one. That's it.
This is what I better keep, then.
Yes, if you can. I don't know whether they'll let you keep it, but those are quite valuable. They really
well,
are.
I don't know either, but now after having listened to you, they're not going to get a chance to get it back because I will just say I lost it.
Well, that's what happens. They're really very, very rare, you know.
No, I didn't know.
Sure.
You think all of our listeners know about a bound galley?
I don't know, but maybe they don't. Why don't you explain what it is?
Why don't you?
Well, a bound...
You're the guest here.
Well, a bound galley, I'll explain what an author goes through. When an author submits his manuscript to... when his final manuscript is given to the publisher, there's a period of waiting when the various people at the publisher they go over it for punctuation and various little mistakes you might have made. And then finally, when they decide to submit it to galley proof, they will turn out a series of long pieces of paper, which are really the real galley.
Fine.
And so then the author gets these galleys, and he then makes any last changes that he wants to make in the book. He goes through, and if he wants to change a word here and there and so forth, he goes through this whole thing. It's a very tedious process. It takes you about 2 weeks of going through with a fine-tooth comb. And then after you've finished that, you send back the galleys to the publisher, and he says, okay, it's now locked in, at which point there's no more changes you can make in a book. And a couple of weeks later, you will receive what they call bound galleys, which are really printed in the same size page as the final book. It doesn't look quite like the final book, but the page size and so on is the same. And actually, not in this case. The pages are not this big in my final book. And also, my final book has drawings, which I have done for the book.
Well, there are never illustrations in bound galleys.
No illustrations at all.
They're always paperback.
And that's what's called a bound galley. And the bound galleys are sent to very special reviewers in that in the country. It may go to the Publishers Weekly, which does a trade review, that goes to the Kirkus people, it goes to people like you who do a lot of book work, and those are very carefully husbanded by the publisher, the bound galleys. They really are.
Now, since we'll do a program later.
Incidentally, they're very expensive to make, among other things, because it's just like turning out a 50 copies of a book. That's it. That's expensive. No, they really are. A bound galley is much more expensive to make for a publisher than, say, a bound final book, which is made in great quantity.
Now, this is marked uncorrected galleys. And I've read I've read The Man of the Future May Be a Woman.
Right.
Because I thought with bound galleys, and you coming to the program this morning, we might talk about one chapter, but not about the book. We better wait until close to publication date. And then if you'll be good enough to come back, we'll do a program on the book.
I'd be really delighted.
Because, I did pick through it, and it's great fun. I don't want
it's a strange book. The people at Dodd Mead, my editor, who's edited a lot of people, he says he's never quite seen a book that is quite as...
Well,
I'll
talk about the title.
The Ferrari in the Bedroom? Well, that title... It comes from one of the essays in the book, which really is a combination of many things. I think that today people look upon sex in many ways as a sporting event.
When did you decide that?
Oh, I've thought about it for some time. I see the day when it's going to be an Olympic main event. You know, Howard Cosell will be on hand, and they'll have 3 minutes. Rounds and so on. and then, of course, there'll be freestyle.
Yeah,
there'll
that.
Be all kinds of variations. There'll be freestyle classical figures that'll be performed. But
I have to take that apart and go back to the word today. You see, sex today is thought of as a sporting event.
I think in many people's minds it is, yeah.
Well,
every sporting event, it's considered very difficult. That's why there's so many books about it, of the David Rubin ilk. You know, how to correct your backswing and how to correct your approach and various other things. And you'll find that anything that is a sporting event involves all kinds of expertise. You know, no one would ever think of playing golf today without at least four or five books that he carries around. you know, Arnold Palmer on the hook. And so you see the great proliferation of books about sex, the how-to books.
Right.
Says that sex has now become a real competitive event.
And everybody needs four or five books.
Oh, at least. I mean, I can just see. I can see two people, you know, with contrasting styles. One has read Reuben, and somebody else has read one of the handbooks that are turned out by lady magazines, and they contrast.
And one has spent a couple of weeks with Masters and Johnson.
Oh yes, of course that's the classical technique. That's not the freeform technique of Reuben, and people who have, you know, who go through the Masters school are going to have a lot of trouble with the Reuben people, who tend to be a little more informal and pragmatic.
You've given this your full attention.
Oh, I have indeed.
Yes.
I mean, sex is one of the major preoccupations of our time.
Or of any time. Our time.
Not necessarily. There was a time when people had a little more reality about it and realized that sex was only part of life. Many people today think it is life. And this has caused a great confusion in a lot of people's minds. Because the mind is willing, but the glands ain't there, you know? And it's a very interesting problem, I tell you. And that's why the title, The Ferrari in the Bedroom, it combines many various philosophies. Because, you know, the Ferrari is a mean, competitive machine. If you know anything about the Ferrari.
No, I don't.
Well, the Ferrari is not your...
Well, I bought the galley.
Well... Martha, the Ferrari is not your average Chevrolet. The Ferrari is one of the great racing machines of all time.
Oh.
Mean, lethal car.
Oh.
It's an automobile.
And I know that.
Well, but it's a special kind of automobile. One does not approach a Ferrari to drive to the A&P.
What does one do in it?
There's only one thing that a Ferrari is good for. That's getting out and beating other Ferraris. That's all.
Oh.
I mean, I
expected one of those rumble seat answers.
You just don't load the Ferrari up with the kids and the dogs and a canoe on the top and tow a trailer behind and go up to Maine. It's just no way. And
you just, what, hot rod around in it?
It's not hot rod. Oh, no. That's a very elegant machine to be hot rodding.
Well, it's not clear to me.
Well,
I'm supposed to do if you give me a Ferrari for Christmas. Instead of a copy of David Rubin's book.
All I could say, if somebody gives you a Ferrari for Christmas, you've hit the double jackpot. And I would suggest that you watch that guy carefully. He's up to no good. Anybody gives you a Ferrari for Christmas.
He isn't likely to, though, is he?
Well, I don't know. I don't know. Beneath those sparkling eyes,
there lies... Well, if somebody gave you one for Christmas, what would you do with it?
Well... A Ferrari, what would I do with it? Well, let me see.
Why would it be so important to change your life?
Well, apparently you don't even know much about the mystique of the Ferrari, so I can see right away I'm going to have trouble with this title. It's like my first book, In God We Trust, All Others Pay Cash.
But I understood that. Well, I dug that.
Well, you might have dug it, but I'll tell you, around the country, it was filed next to Billy Graham books. It was filed under God and religion. And I suspect that my book, The Ferrari in the Bedroom, is either going to be filed under Italian cooking or quite
automotive possible. Guide.
That's right, automotive guides, I'll tell you. You think I'm being funny, but, you know, this is so true. Robert Benchley wrote a beautiful essay on that. You know, I think Benchley wrote more funny stuff about the whole thing of writing than anybody who ever wrote.
I do, too.
And he explained at the beginning of one of his books, he said, you know, the last time I turned out a book, he says, I made a terrible mistake. He said, I called to tennis anyone? And he said, I thought this was a funny line. He said, except that they gave it to the sporting editor of the Times to review. And he was serious. He says, very serious. He says, the New York Times, it was reviewed by the tennis editor. And he said, so now I've decided to go all the way. He says, and now I want them to know it's a book, a definite book. So the name of this new book is David Copperfield or 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. He says, now I'm sure that it's going to be given to the fishing editor. this is so true, and people think this is not possible. But yet, it's funny. You take Wanda Hickey now, my last book. Wanda Hickey's Night of Golden Memories, a collection of short stories. Well, would you believe it or not that it was treated by the people who do Time Magazine, for example. Time Magazine listed it in its bestseller list under nonfiction. Well, it was fiction.
Of course.
Yeah, well, but it was written in the first person, so they assumed it was nonfiction, you know. And so book reviewers are the most literal people. I won't say they're literate. They're literal people.
Well, I think it'll be marvelous to have the Ferrari in the bedroom reviewed
now
by
I'm worried about
automotive
it.
Engineer.
See, I thought automatically you would know what a Ferrari is.
Well, I know it's a car.
Person of your wide acquaintance
absolutely.
Among the demi monde.
Oh, say that again. I like that. I know it's a car.
Well, it's a special type of car. It's a car. Anybody who buys a Ferrari is saying something about himself. To begin with, he lives life to the hilt, and he's no thoughts for the future. One does not buy a Ferrari saying, "Gee, I wonder what the trade-in value is going to be next year." One never questions how much gas mileage you get on a Ferrari. By the way, they make the only 12-cylinder car that's made in the world today. It's a 12, it's a racing 12. Every Ferrari is built in the racing tradition. They're all basically racing machines. There's no such thing as a Ferrari station.
Well, now the title is perfectly clear to me.
Right. It's a
Ferrari
mean
in
car.
The bedroom.
And the Ferrari in the bedroom.
12-cylinder job.
Right. And the Ferrari in the bedroom refers to the fact there's certain guys, certain people who approach this arena, the bedroom, as a total sporting event, one that is meant to be won.
Now, let me tell you, this is not a dirty book.
No, not at all.
In fact, it's a very clean book.
Well, your particular copy has a lot of fingerprints all over it, but that's what's, you know, that's your own problem, right? It was clean when you got it. That's all I can say.
All right. Now, the man of the future may be a woman. That's one chapter head.
Right.
Which is a separate piece. Which begins...
You better not read it. You said it was clean. You better be careful.
Oh, that's right.
I had one reviewer says, now I'm going to read a particular paragraph. And he started to read, you know, and how many reviewers don't necessarily, on the air, on television, and they don't necessarily read it over before they start. And this one clipped right through the first paragraph in one of my books, and a very juicy word came right out before he could stop himself.
Well, you just stopped me.
Sales
now, Gene, I read this chapter. The man, I told you, and I wasn't fooling you, the man of the future may be a woman, and I think it would make a very interesting discussion. But I'd forgotten the last line in that first paragraph, and I can't read it on
the
air.
No, you can't, no.
No.
Not today, at least. A couple of years, you may be able to.
Yeah, I wouldn't be.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I think there's another subject. I think there's a trend away from that. Had you
yes,
noticed?
Yes, I think so, yeah.
You noticed that fewer and fewer people are using four-letter words in the last 6 months?
That's quite true. I think that's true. Yeah.
Isn't it?
There's a lot of changes going on in the country, and I think our election yesterday showed that in many ways. And I think we're starting a whole new... See, I think societies go in great plateaus. And I think that we are seeing, and we did see in the last of the 60s, the end of one plateau and the beginning of another.
Right.
Now, what that new plateau is, I'm not prepared yet to say. Who knows?
I mean, Gene, let me do some work right here on WR New York. Let's go to Alexis Lachine. All right?
Oh, fine. That's fine. At this hour of the morning, that's an elegant way to start the day.
You're not supposed to drink wine this hour in the morning.
Well, it depends on who you are. A little rosé and sliced iced pear. That's the elegant way to live. For breakfast.
In a Ferrari.
In a Ferrari, of course.
In the bedroom.
You live such a plebeian life. I'm sorry.
Oh, absolutely. No Ferrari in the bedroom. No share. Alexis Lachine on sliced pear on ice. In the bedroom.
Oh, that's a nice way to start it. Dick loves that. Look at his glasses clouding up.
All right, Alexis Lachine is to this country. And this is the Martha Dean program, WOR New York. My guest this morning is Gene Shepherd. Gene Shepherd. And there's the new Gene Shepherd book, and I'm glad. I'm a fan. I always have fun with
you. You were one of the first people who encouraged me in my writing, you know. I remember that a long time ago when I first came to the station here, and you kept after me, nagging me about writing. You remember that?
Yes, I do remember, but I didn't know you did.
Oh, I sure do. I used to go out of here feeling conscience-stricken. I was in the studio, and you'd say, when are you going to write? I'd leave the studio, you know, walking with my head hanging low.
Well, I'm very pleased about you, because, you know, sometimes as you get older and you see somebody who has a special talent, you sort of mention to them you ought to do something about this, and then they do nothing.
Oh, I've seen so many
but
people.
But you just got right to it. That marvelous book about George Ade.
That book I'm quite proud of. You know, that's still a library textbook. It's in libraries all over the country, and it's an interesting book. I think Ade is due for a great revival anyway. I've said this for a long time.
I know. Oh, it was a superb book. Right from the beginning.
You know, it's funny. My career as a writer, which most people, I suppose, in New York are not particularly aware of because my books are nationally and internationally distributed, and they're not specifically related to New York. It's an interesting career. I mean, I know a lot more now about the world after observing the various convolutions that my books take. And now this is my fourth book, major book.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting how the accumulative reputation you get. You know, I used to hear that from publishers. A publisher would say, well, look, people don't take you seriously as a writer until at least your second or third book. You may have a big cause celeb, but after... And that's quite true.
It's
literally true. And and it's a very interesting developmental thing I have. And by the way, you learn to write better. The more you write, the better you get at it, and the more control you have over what you're doing.
I agree. I think that's anything you do day after day, you get better at, don't you?
Yeah. Although up to a certain point, I'd agree with that. I think that there is a little there is a limit. In other words, you can overwrite. I think the problem with most hacks is that they write too much, and they become there's a certain glibness that comes. It's like automatic writing doesn't often have enough of a focus. That can be a problem. I find especially a writer who commits himself to having a book every year, that you begin to see, well, some famous writers have done that, you know. They want to have a book every couple of years. They want to keep their name out there. And you see where their writing goes through cycles of where they've just sat down and they've turned this thing out just like so much salami. And they probably think they're writing well, but you get overtrained. It's like an athlete, too. He can overtrain. He can practice too much.
Your story is interesting, though, because in my head, it interests me because I thought of you as a broadcaster and a good one who wrote a little. And I don't.
No way.
Now I think of you as a writer. And I said, you know,
well, I
think
that's
a really good writer.
Well,
too.
I think
not
that's hurt my career in this town,
writer.
You know, because
who does some broadcasting?
Yeah, most. Well, it has hurt me in New York in a sense that the fact that you're a broadcaster. You know, this is the first country that believes that a man is only capable of one talent. It's not true in Europe that an actor can also be a fine playwright. And has been, including Shakespeare, among others.
Including Jason Miller right now.
Well, there have been many. But in America, this is always looked upon as very suspect, that actors...
You're supposed to specialize.
You're supposed... Many an actor I know... Well, it's not that you're supposed to specialize. People tend to look upon your product with suspicion.
Did you do more than one thing?
Yes. For example... let's take the case of Tom Tryon, who wrote The Other. Now, Tryon, almost every reviewer seemed to express astonishment that an actor could write a book like this. It would never occur to them to be surprised that, say, a college sophomore from a university in southern Texas could write a good book. Larry. It is strange, but it's part of our cliche-ridden time. And I have, I know perfectly well that many reviewers here in New York City approach me the way you said. I'm a broadcaster who dabbles in writing. Not so. You do not turn out 4 books in 5 years dabbling.
Well, you might.
Well, I don't
because
know
because I
you
get
could.
Some books that have been written dabbling. I'm talking about good books by a good writer like you.
Well, that's what I mean. I don't see any. Seriously, I don't see how you could that writing, especially on a national level, when for example, most of my short stories have appeared in Playboy, I have very high standards. One of the most difficult markets to crack. This is not dabbling. That's roughly like saying, you know, you've come in third in the Bing Crosby Invitational Golf Tournament as a dabbler. You just don't do that. No way.
You play golf?
I play a little. I played in my first major tournament last year.
Are you any good?
Well, no, but I'm honest about that. Let's put it this way. My heart's in the right place, but the head of the club is rarely.
Gene, now we have to go into the Ferrari in the bedroom. The title kills me now that you've explained it. We have to do a program about this soon, I hope.
Oh, any time. I'm delighted to do it, as you know. But I don't know what, I'm curious when you see the final bound copies, because the bound copies have drawings. The first time one of my books, I've illustrated it myself with drawings. And,
not only a broadcaster and a writer, he also will. I better just look at Dick's face now, and his glasses are clouded for another reason. I have to do Robert Hall. Robert Hall, all they want me to find it. In your favorite supermarket. It features yams and marshmallows mellowed together for a delicious holiday recipe. Dress your dinner table with America's finest, Royal Prince and Princella yams, always a holiday tradition.
Remember what their slogan is, I am what I am.
I am what I am.